My name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website. And I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 95. I'm recording it on Monday, February 16th, 2009. The P10 level today is 14. That's fair value. Stocks purchased at today's prices offer a strong long-term value proposition. The music for the podcast is by Kevin McLeod at the Incompetech.com site. The name of this selection is Morning Snowflake Part 2. That's not true. That's a little joke for people who listen to the last podcast, number 94. The real name of the podcast is Heavy Interlude. And the title of the podcast is Risk Tolerance in the Real World. This is a big issue. There are people, it's very sad. I am a believer, if you've listened to the other podcast, you know, I am a big believer in learning about personal finance in general and investing in particular by listening, by reading discussion boards. And the reason I'm a big believer in that idea is that I also believe in reading books and studies and all that sort of thing. But my problem with reading books and studies is that often what happens is that the discussion becomes artificial. It becomes excessively abstract. And people get all caught up in their theories, their ideas. And I'm an idea person. I like ideas. But ideas can only take you so far. You have to ground your ideas in reality, in the reality principle. And you go to discussion boards, and that's where you see how the ideas are being implemented by real, living, breathing, middle-class investors. So I think we can learn a lot through the use of this new internet discussion board communications medium. And something that's going on, of course, I talk all the time about the problems of passive investing, how passive investing has let us down, the troubles it's causing people. And people are talking about, you know, they what's sad is that people are talking about it today. We've obviously experienced the stock crash last year, the passive investing stock crash of 2008. And a lot of people are shaken in their belief in passive investing, but the way they're dealing with it today is they're saying, oh, I'm shaken in my belief in stocks. They're thinking of giving up on stocks. Instead of giving up on this crazy investing strategy, they're giving up on stocks in general, which is a terrible mistake, in my opinion. But one thing that has come out of this that is somewhat, well, there's more than one positive thing, but one thing that is especially positive that has come out of the discussion so far is that people are going back and re-examining the question of risk tolerance. There are a lot of people who are not passive investing enthusiasts who have not yet reached the point where they're willing to acknowledge that passive investing has failed. They're still hanging on by a thread. And they're trying to rationalize and they're trying to make excuses. And what they come up with is, well, you know, passive investing's all right, but the problem is we misestimated our risk tolerance. That's it. That's the problem. If only we'd gotten that risk tolerance thing better, then none of this would have happened. Everything would be fine. And it certainly is true that under passive investing, investors who follow the passive investing model get risk tolerance questions horribly wrong. That's, of course, not the core problem. The core problem is passive investing makes it impossible to talk about risk tolerance in a meaningful way. This is why I don't, you know, this is my big beef with passive investing. It's not just that it causes financial losses, which it does. It's that it makes it impossible to learn about investing. because passive investing is a straitjacket. It's so obviously wrong, the idea that you don't need to change your stock allocation in response to wild changes in price of stocks, wild changes in valuation. That idea is so obviously wrong that in order to avoid coming to grips with the fact that your strategy doesn't make sense, you engage in just incredible amounts of rationalization to avoid talking straight. And so that's what we're seeing. And people are sort of catching on that risk tolerance is an issue here, but they're not confronting it in a direct way. But this is the cop out that we're seeing. You know, I had a podcast where I talked about Money Magazine and how Money Magazine got right to the threshold of acknowledging that the investing advice they've been giving for 36 years now is wrong. That passive investing is a horrible, horrible mistake. But instead of concluding that, they ended up saying, oh, well, passive investing is okay. It's just, you know, stocks are riskier than we realized. Our risk tolerance assessment, you know, was not done properly. And that's a cop-out. It's not that the risk it's true that the risk tolerance assessment was not done properly. But the reason why that happened is that we fell into this passive investing mindset. And once you start thinking about things in this crazy way, all of your assessments are wrong. Your assessments of the safe withdrawal rate are wrong. Your assessments of risk tolerance are wrong. Your assessments of your asset allocation are wrong. Everything is wrong because you cannot think about stocks clearly. So in this podcast, I'm going to try to explore the risk tolerance question from a rational investing perspective. How would you go about setting your risk tolerance or deciding what your risk tolerance is if you were a rational investor instead of a passive investor? And for newcomers, passive investors are people who believe that there's no need to change your stock allocation, even when stock prices go to insanely dangerous levels, as they did from 1995 through the first part of 2008. Rational investors are just the opposite. Rational investors say you must change your stock allocation when stock prices go to insanely dangerous levels. If you want to have any realistic hope of achieving long-term investing success. Risk tolerance to the passive investor is an inward directed thing. The type of thing they will say is, the classic case really is to go back to the Graney study. John Graney, he's the leader of the goons in the retire early community, but he also is a friend of mine from the days before the great safe withdrawal rate debate. And John has a study on safe withdrawal rates at his website. And John's website is retireearlyhomepage.com with no spaces, no hyphens. Go to retireearlyhomepage.com and you'll find a study on safe withdrawal rates. And within that study, John talks about what he calls the optimal stock allocation. The optimal stock allocation. And, you know, basically he looks at the historical data and he says the stock allocation that gives the best return over the long run is 74%. That's what he calls the optimal stock allocation. And that means that, you know, by optimal, what he means is if you have a stock allocation less than that, you're making a mistake. And if you have a stock allocation more than that, you're making a mistake. Now, the flaw in his study of the optimal asset allocation is the same flaw that he makes with the safe withdrawal rate. With the safe withdrawal rate, he says the safe withdrawal rate is 4%. And he does that again by looking at the historical data. The mistake, of course, he makes, we've talked about this before, is that he just mixes all of the various valuation levels together. He says it's 4% when stocks are low valued, when they're moderate valued, and when they're high valued. It makes no difference. The reality is the safe withdrawal rate is a variable number. It's not a constant. And I have a safe withdrawal rate calculator at my website, the Retirement Risk Evaluator. And that will give you the numbers that apply at different valuation levels. So, for example, if you retire at a time when stock prices are very high, the safe withdrawal rate can drop down to 2%, not 4%. At times of moderate prices like today, the safe withdrawal rate's around 5%. And then at times of very low prices, the safe withdrawal rate can rise to as high as 9%. So it's a varying number. Well, the same thing, of course, is true with the optimal stock allocation. There is no one optimal stock allocation. 74% is the number you get if you mix all of the various valuation levels together into a big bowl of data soup. Then you do indeed get 74%. John did the calculations properly, but he used an analytically invalid methodology to for his investigation. So 74% sounds high, but it's really not. That is the number you get. Now, that doesn't mean, you know, it would be wrong to say that everyone should be invested 74% in stocks, because that's where you get into this question of risk tolerance. Obviously, if your risk tolerance is higher than most people, you would want to go with something less than the optimal number. And if your risk tolerance is higher, you might want to go with something higher. But your risk tolerance has to come into play as well. But the idea that there's one optimal asset allocation, that idea is just crazy. In order for that to be true, valuations would have to have zero effect on long-term returns. If changes in valuations affect the long-term return, then you obviously should be changing your stock allocation in response to big changes in prices. So if you check the historical data, that's just what you find. So, for example, there are some, if we're very low stock allocations, the best stock, the optimal stock allocation at a, look at the stock return predictor and plug in a PE10 level of 7 or 8, where we were in 1982 at the beginning of the big bull market, and you'll find that the most likely annualized real return for 10 years is 17% per year. Well, the optimal stock allocation during a time when you're getting an annual return of 17% real is 100%. You want to be heavily in stocks at such a time. And in contrast, at the top of the bull market, at the top of the out of control bull market, the January of 2000, the most likely 10-year annualized real return was a negative 1%. Well, when the return you're going to get on stocks for 10 years running is a negative number, you don't want to be going with 100% stocks. You might want to go with 0% stocks, or maybe 10% or 20% stocks. You want to go with a low stock allocation. So the optimal stock allocation varies. It's not any one number. That's the key. You know, that's the key insight. And if you understand that, everything else sort of follows, but I want to explore some of the things that do follow and express sadness and regret that those who endorse passive investing are not even able, it's not that they're not able to come to the right conclusions, they're not even able to ask the right questions, they're not even able to struggle with these questions, because once they acknowledge that valuations affect long-term returns, their belief in passive investing crumbles to the ground. You cannot maintain a belief in passive investing if you understand that valuations affect long-term returns. And if you don't understand that valuations affect long-term returns, you don't understand the ABCs of stock investing. It's the most basic concept. It's everything you could learn about how to invest effectively in the real world depends on understanding that valuations affect long-term returns. And the passive investor is blind to this. So it's very sad. But we are seeing a lot of discussions of this question. And I think those discussions are healthy and promising and encouraging, because what's happening is that people who have followed passive investing today are upset. They've lost a lot of money. They understand they may be losing a lot more in days to come. And they're not yet at the point, unfortunately, where they're willing to abandon passive investing, but they are at the point where they're saying, why doesn't this work? You know, maybe we need to make some... They're at the point today where they're sort of in the compromising stage. You know, you read about the five stages of grief, and I don't recall what they all are, The five stages are grief. I know anger, I think, is one. Denial is one. Negotiation is one. Acceptance is one. I don't know. Is shock one of them? I don't know. So I got four of them, I think. I'm not sure about the fifth one. We're in a stage now, I would say, where the passive investing enthusiasts are not as angry as they used to be. They're not totally in denial. There's some shock, but the shock is wearing off. There was shock in the early months after the price crash, but that's sort of wearing off. I think people are settling in now for the long haul. They're starting to say, yeah, we're not going to go back to where we were. They're getting that. So the shock is sort of passing. The anger, it's still there, but not the way it used to be. We see much less anger. We certainly do not see acceptance. People are not willing to accept that passive investing cannot work in the real world. But I think we're seeing we're sort of entering, I'd say, a negotiation stage. That's what I see in these threads on risk tolerance. What they're saying is, hey, I don't want to give up passive investing. That's too important to me. I have believed in passive investing for so long now, and I've told all my friends about it, and I would feel like a fool to admit that I was wrong. I can't do that. That's asking too much. But I might be willing to acknowledge that I estimated my risk tolerance improperly. I might be willing to do that. Or I might even be willing to say that passive investors in general have underestimated their risk tolerance or poorly estimated their risk tolerance. So see, they're giving. They're not saying, they're saying they were wrong about something. They're saying they were wrong about a small thing rather than the big thing. And it's sad because obviously they could learn so much more. We could move forward so much faster if we could get people to acknowledge they're wrong about the big thing. And we could bring in all the academic research of the past 30 years that shows that valuations affect long-term returns and change the history of investing overnight and help people to regain confidence in the markets and in the economic system and in the political system. All those things are doable. But let's thank God for small favors. We are seeing passive investing enthusiasts become a little more willing to acknowledge at least small mistakes, that they're not perfect, that they're not masterminds, as Graney used to call himself in the old days. He used to say he was a mastermind investor. That's beginning to fade. So what I want to do here is explore a little bit, how would you go, when we get to the other side, when we've reached this magical time, when the passive investing enthusiasts are able to say just, flat out, we were wrong. We want to invest rationally. We want to learn what works. Let's look at all that academic research from the past 30 years. What will we becoming? What sorts of decisions will we be arriving at then? And I think a basic question here is, risk tolerance to the passive investor is always an inward directed thing. Let me start by saying, all that we're dealing with when we talk about passive investing, we're talking about a set of ideas that came out of academic research. At one time, people thought these ideas worked, came out of the efficient market theory. And these ideas were developed in a practical sense by John Bogle, the founder of Vanguard, and his name is the one most closely associated with them. And I believe that John Bogle, most of what he wrote was gold. And what he still writes today is gold. But he was wrong about passive investing. And that sort of poisons the well. And if you get that part wrong, you get it all wrong, because passive investing is such a disaster that it makes it impossible to implement any of the rest. But we don't want to abandon Bogle's ideas or Eugene Fama's ideas or Burton Malkiel's ideas. What we want to do is develop these ideas, make these ideas workable in the real world. So one of the ideas that Bogle has and that all passive investing enthusiasts have is that they have this concept, they call it stay the course or buy and hold. The idea being you need to adopt the plan and then stick to it. And it's closely associated with the idea that you need to be a long-term investor, not a short-term investor. And that's where I think Bogle hits it right on the head. The key to successful stock investing is becoming a long-term investor, sticking to your plan, staying the course, as he calls it. I don't believe it's possible to stay the course as a passive investor. To stay the course, you must change your stock allocation when prices change dramatically. Because if you don't, your risk level changes dramatically. And you want to keep your risk level roughly constant. But he's on the right track. When Bogle says stay the course, he's very much on the right track. That is the key to successful long-term investing. Now, if they didn't have this concept of risk tolerance, they would do what Graney did. They would just say 74% is optimal. And they would just say everybody should invest 74% in stocks. Now that sounds, I'm laughing because it sounds so idiotic. But that's just what Graney used to do at the Motley Fool board. He used to say everybody should be 74%. And if someone said different, you know, I got into the whole discussion, the whole safe withdrawal rate debate began because Graney would attack various community members who veered away from the orthodoxy. And I was trying to salvage the board. I had spent years of my life building this board up, and I wanted to salvage it. I didn't want all the best posters to leave. And so I felt obligated to come forward and say what I knew about safe withdrawal rates in an attempt to save that board community. But Graney would say everybody should be at 74%. Now, he did acknowledge that for some people that wasn't right. But the way he would put it was, if you didn't want to go with a 74% stock allocation, he'd say, well, say you're a scaredy cat. That's sort of the way he would put it. Say you're afraid of stocks. He'd say, well, if you're afraid, you'll have to go with a lower allocation. I understand you're a scaredy cat, Rob. You can't go with a 74% allocation. That's okay. You're allowed to go. But then he would say, well, if you're going to be a scaredy cat, it's going to take you longer to retire. You can't retire early if you're a scaredy cat because you're going to get less. Your returns are going to be less because your allocation is not optimal. You see? There is a logic there. I mean, it's the conclusions are idiotic, but there is a logic chain at work. And what's going on is that Graney is buying into the idea that valuations don't matter. And therefore, he concludes that 74% isn't just the average of all the various optimal allocations. He's come to believe that 74% is always the optimal allocation, that even at times of insanely high prices, 74% is optimal. And he believes this. I am convinced that he believes this. So he believes that, of course, he does acknowledge, he says, look, if you're a scaredy cat and you can't, you know, you don't have the risk tolerance great enough to go with 74%, go with something less. But then, you know, you have to be honest about it. You have to acknowledge that's going to delay your retirement. You're not gonna get the same results as the non-scaredy cats. Now, it's all crazy. It's all gibberish. But it does follow logically from the premise of the passive investing model. And this is what people have to get. A lot of people will say, oh, you know, why do you need to talk about theory? What difference does it make whether passive investing works or not? Just tell me what I need to do. Tell me what my allocation should be. I can't. The only way you can figure out what your allocation should be is to understand how stock investing works. And if you think passive investing can work, you don't understand the ABCs of stock investing. The entire historical record shows that this approach can never work in the real world. Passive investing is madness. The truth is that valuations affect long-term returns, and that the optimal stock allocation is not one allocation. It's to change your allocation in response to big price changes so that your risk level remains roughly constant. Now, I'll give you a simple rule that I use to think about risk tolerance. I think this is probably the simplest way to think about it. If, see what happens, what's happened is we have moved, in the old days we didn't think about stock investing as being a long-term endeavor. Most people thought about the short term. They thought about, this is where we came up with this terminology of bulls and bears and all this sort of thing. How people thought about stock investing is, how are stocks going to do the next 6 months? How are they going to do the next year? How are they going to do the next 2 years? That's what people were aiming to determine. And what Bogle did was he pushed us into a new paradigm where we're thinking about investing for the long term. But the trouble is, we went into the new paradigm without really understanding a lot of things about stock investing. We're still at a primitive level of our understanding. So we got some very important things wrong. And because we got those things wrong, we're not really long-term investors today. Bogleheads are not long-term investors. It's impossible to have a long-term focus while believing in passive investing. And so we've been held back. And what we need to do is get over the passive investing hurdle, get over the craziness, and then we can start thinking about, what do we need to do to be genuinely long-term investors? And that's the secret to success. So say that you are a long-term investor. Say that you've given up passive investing and you want to put together a plan to invest for the long term. How would you go about doing it? Well, the first thing I would do is to say, look, what is long-term investing? Say that you begin investing somewhere between age 20 and 25, and say that you expect to live to something between 80 and 85. So you're going to be investing for 60 years, maybe 65 years, maybe 70 years, but say at least 60 years. You've got to have an approach to investing that will work for a 60-year time period. Okay? If you're going to invest for 60 years in stocks, and you want to be a buy and hold investor, you don't want to be jumping in and out, you want to be a long-term investor, there's certain things you know are going to happen. You can look at the historical data and verify this if you don't believe what I'm telling you. If you're going to invest for 60 years, you are going to have a time period in your investing lifetime when the PE10 level is going to drop to 7, which is a very low PE10 level, half of fair value. The fair value PE10 level is 14. If you're going to invest for 60 years, I can guarantee you, you're going to have a time, you know, during your investing lifetime when the PE10 level is going to drop to something in the neighborhood of 7. It might be 8, it might be 9, but it's going to be close. Could be 5. But you're almost certainly going to have some time period when you're going to see PE10 level of around 7. And if you're going to invest for 60 years, I can tell you something else. You're also going to have a time. You're obviously going to have a time when the PE10 level is going to be around 14, which is fair value, which is where we are today. You're obviously going to have many times. That's the normal PE10 level, so you're going to see that often. But you're also going to have a time in your investing lifetime when the PE10 level is 21, double. I'm sorry, not double. You're going to have a time in your investing lifetime when the PE10 level is somewhere close to 28, which is double fair value. Fair value is 14. There's going to come a time when stocks are going to be half of fair value, and there's going to become a time when stocks are double fair value if you're going to invest for 60 years. Might not happen in 5 years or 10 years, but it's surely going to happen in 60. Now that tells you important information. What it tells you is, in order to stick with your plan, you're going to have to be able to accept the portfolio value you will have at a PE10 level of 7, and you're going to have to keep in mind, it's not hard to accept the results you'll have at a PE10 level of 28, but you need to keep that in mind in setting your stock allocation. That a P10 level of 28 is going to happen. And, you know, you would probably like to see some of the benefits of that. So you can't plan just for the normal P10 level of 14. You've got to plan for the extremes. Now, this is what the passive investors don't do. And this is why passive investing can never work as a long-term investing strategy. In January of 2000, we were at a P10 level of 44. The highest we've ever seen in history. Now, I've just told you, if you're a long-term investor, which Bogle has claimed to be, then you know that during your investing lifetime, you're going to see a PE10 level of 7. And the current PE10 level is 14. Say that you just got your first job at January of 2000, and you now have money to invest. And you're putting money in stocks for the first time. You know, and you want to be a long-term investor, you know that you are going to see a drop in P10 level from 44 down to 7. That's a drop of 5/6. It's a drop of over 80%. It's a huge drop in portfolio value. You've got to ask yourself, how do I feel about that? You don't know when it's going to come. I can't tell you it's going to come in a year or 2 years or 5 years. I don't know. But I know you're going to see it. And of course, if you're serious about being a long-term investor, you want to be able to stick with stocks or stick with your plan, even in a worst-case scenario. Well, the worst-case scenario is it'll happen, in a couple years. You'll see this drop, where you'll lose 5/6 of your accumulated wealth of a lifetime. That's too much. You see, when you follow the rational model, it's not hard to think about risk tolerance. Anybody with a tenth of a brain in his or her head knows that to lose over 80% of your accumulated wealth of a lifetime is too much. So you're not going to go with a big stock allocation when the P10 level is 44. Conversely, say that you were investing in 1982 and the P10 level is 7 or 8. You know that if you hold on to stocks, we're going to be, sometime during your lifetime, you're going to be at a P10 level of 28. That's a quadrupling of your money. You want to be going with a high stock allocation. If you're putting money into stocks at a time when the P10 level is 7 or 8. Now, what passive investors do is, you see, they can't talk about this sort of thing. They can't talk about how returns change based on changes in valuation, because passive investors really, they can't talk about valuations in any meaningful way at all, because to acknowledge that you should be changing your allocation based on valuations is a violation of principle one of passive investing. The thing you're passive about is your stock allocation. You never change it. Well, if you never change your stock allocation, what you're saying is I'm never going to invest effectively, because effective investing means knowing when to change your stock allocation. And your first thing you're doing, becoming a passive investor, saying I won't do that. I vow today that I will never invest effectively, and I'll stick to that plan throughout my life. That can't work. So what passive investors do is they turn it all inward. They adopt this scaredy cat approach. They say, oh, some investors, the brave, the few and the brave and the strong, they'll go with a 74% allocation. But the scaredy cats, they might only go with 60% or 50%. It's okay to be a scaredy cat. It's okay. We understand. Now, someone put it that way. You know, it depends on the personality of the person. If the person is a, you know, one of these dogmatists, they'll say you're a scaredy cat. Granny will say it. Mel Lindauer will say it. But if you know, a lot of them, Taylor Larimore probably wouldn't say it that way, and a lot of them won't. So how they say it, that's a matter of personal preference. That's a matter of individual personality. But the idea that they're putting forward is the same, regardless of how they say it. The idea is you're better off in stocks because stocks provide a strong long-term value proposition, and that's just not always true. It's generally true when we're at valuation levels that are reasonable. It's certainly true, but it's certainly not true at the valuation levels that applied from 1995 through the first part of 2008. And the passive investing dogmatists simply cannot admit that. They can't admit that because once they admit that, they're not passive investors anymore. They've acknowledged the insanity of this approach. So what the passive investing dogmatist will tell you is you should look inward. You sort of have to psychoanalyze yourself and say, oh, am I a scaredy cat? Am I a risk, you know, am I an entrepreneur, risk-taking entrepreneur? All this, first of all, nobody can psychoanalyze himself or herself. The very idea is preposterous. I don't know how you feel about, you know, psychotherapy, where somebody, you know, a shrink tries to analyze you. I have mixed feelings about it. I think there are circumstances where it does good, and there are circumstances where it's probably a waste of time. But it depends. But, you know, even somebody who believes strongly in the idea of psychotherapy, if you ask them, you know, can somebody psychotherapize themselves? They'll tell you no. You know, the whole problem, if somebody's suffering with some sort of psychological problem or emotional problem, the whole problem is that they've lost objectivity. They're, you know, if you're capable of regulating your own behavior properly, you don't have a problem. So you can't psychoanalyze yourself. You can't sit in a room and say, here's what I'm going to do in such and such a circumstance. Nobody knows what they're going to do. And what we're seeing play out before us, you know, people like Taylor Larimore, he's the co-author of The Boglehead's Guide to Investing. He had far too high a stock allocation because he believes in passive investing. He believes in all the gibberish. And now he's saying he has a plan B, which is sell all your stocks after prices have fallen 50%. And some are upset about that. They're saying that's crazy. It's a violation of passive investing. Well, it is and it isn't. It's a violation in that he's obviously not staying the course. In that sense, it's a violation. But it's not a violation in another sense, because it's every bit as emotional as the idea of overinvesting in stocks. Selling all your stocks after prices have fallen is every bit as emotional as going with an excessive stock allocation when prices are high. It's just two sides of the same coin. Extremes beget extremes. And if you're going to ignore valuations and invest heavily in stocks when the prices are what they were from 95 through the first part of 2008, it's perfectly consistent for you to sell all your stocks after the crash. Because what you are is an emotional investor. It's just two sides of the same emotional coin. What we need to do to become successful long-term investors is to overcome the emotion. That's the goal. So what you want to do is you don't want to look inside this foolish quest of psychoanalyzing yourself. Most of us are the same. You know, the thing that Taylor is now putting forward, he's saying under Plan B, he's saying Plan B is never invest any money in stocks you can't afford to lose. Now, that is just about the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Never invest any money in stocks you can't afford to lose. What the heck does that mean? Nobody wants to lose their retirement money. If you're going to lose it, why would you put it in there in the first place? It makes no sense. Now, if what he means is, and he says that Bogle endorses this idea, never invest any money in stocks you can't afford to lose. Yeah, that rules out stock investing for most of us. Most of us want our money to increase. That's why we're investing. We don't want to lose it. You know, I don't want to lose 10% of my money. Why would I want to? I want it to increase, not diminish. Now, if what he means is that I might lose, I might lose something temporarily, well, that I'm fine with. In other words, say that the risk of investing in stocks is that I might suffer a 30% loss in my money that would remain in place for 5 years. And in return for taking on the risk of a 30% loss that stays in place for 5 years, I would get the higher returns that are available from stocks, as opposed to the lower returns that would be available in a safer asset class, like a money market or I-bonds or whatever. Well, in those circumstances, okay. In those circumstances, I might say, okay, I am willing to lose. But you see, that's not a permanent loss. I'm not putting the money into stocks in order to lose it. I'm putting the money in with the thought that, oh, I might lose for a couple years, but I'm going to get it back. In the long term, I'm going to be ahead of the game, not behind. But if you're going to be ahead, if you're sure you're going to be ahead, then of course you always want to be in stocks. You want to be 100% in stocks. I mean, why wouldn't you if you're going to be ahead? And if you're using the money for your retirement that, you know, is not going to take place till, you know, a good number of years down the road. The problem with all of these rules of thumb that they use, you know, the passive investors use, is they never define what they're talking about with enough clarity for anyone to be able to make any sense out of it. What people need to know is, how much can I lose? You know, how much can I lose? What percentage of my portfolio is at risk? How great a loss am I looking at? And two, how long is that loss likely to remain in place? Those are the two key questions. And you'll never see passive investors discuss these questions with any exactitude. They can't. Because if they discuss these two questions with any precision whatsoever, passive investing comes crumbling to the ground. Because the question of how much you can lose, that depends on the valuation level. It changes dramatically, depending on what sort of valuation level you're investing at. So you can't answer that question. You can't even begin to assess your risk tolerance until you look at the valuation level. And of course, passive investors can never do that. If they look at valuations and acknowledge that valuations affect long-term returns, they're not passive investors anymore. And the other thing they can't look at is how long the loss remains in place. Because the basic trickery at the root of all the passive investing nonsense, and I don't mean to say that it's intentional, it's what seems to be going on, is that the passive investing advocates trick themselves first and then trick everybody else that they talk to. But the basic trickery is that they refuse to give, to specify the time period that they're talking about. All of the rules of passive investing that you have heard, all of them, they're all correct. If you are willing to wait 30 years. Okay? I am the most severe critic of passive investing alive on planet Earth today. I challenge you to find somebody who has made stronger statements against passive investing. And I am here to tell you, the most severe critic of passive investing alive on planet Earth today, I am here to tell you, if your time period is 30 years, everything that the passive investing enthusiasts tell you is 100% true. It all works. When I say it doesn't work, I'm not talking about 30 years. When I talk about the long term, I'm talking about 10 years, unless I specify otherwise. To go out 30 years, I think, is preposterous. We don't live in 30-year time periods. We live in 5 and 10 and 15-year time periods. So we need to know how stocks are going to do 5 years out, and 10 years out, and 15 years out, not 30 years out. And 10 years out is often a very, 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 very different story from 30 years out. You know, I talked about January of 2000. Well, 10 years out, the most likely annualized real return is a negative 1% per year. You're going to lose money on average every year for 10 years. But 30 years out, that's not true. 30 years out, if I recall, the 30 years out for stocks purchased in January of 2000, the most likely 30-year annualized return is about 5.4% real. That's not at all bad. That's a pretty darn good return. That beats what you can get from tips, beats what you can get from I-bonds, surely beats what you can get from money markets. 30 years out, it works, but not 10 years. 10 years out, passive investing is an unmitigated disaster. It means you're putting your money into an asset class where you're going to lose money every year. You're going to fall farther and farther behind. But see, this distinction, if you make this distinction, if you tell people about it, passive investing crumbles to the ground. Because nobody, I've never run into a middle-class investor who wanted to know what works 30 years out. We all want to know what's going to work 5 years out, 10 years out, 15 years out. None of us are looking for what's going to work 30 years out. But that's what passive investing is. It's a solution to a problem that nobody has. Nobody wants to know what's going to happen 30 years out. In the real world, we're trying to find out what's going to happen 10 years out. And passive investing doesn't tell you the right answers. So, what I'm saying is, in order to assess your risk tolerance, what you need to do is forget about this psychoanalyzing yourself nonsense. It's idiotic. It can't be done, first of all. And it wouldn't do you any good if you could do it. Because psychoanalyzing yourself won't tell you what the valuation level is. And without knowing the valuation level, you can't get the right answer. There is no one asset allocation that works at all valuation levels. So forget that gibberish. What you need to do is look outward. Don't look inward. Don't analyze yourself. Look outward. What you have to figure out is, what sort of environment am I in? And whether you're a scaredy cat or a lion, you're going to come to the same general conclusion. None of us like to lose all of our retirement money. You know, this is not a psychological issue. It's a common sense issue. It has nothing to do with scaredy cats versus lions. There was a statistic I used to cite at the Vanguard Diehards board when I post it there. People be saying, oh, I'm at 80% stocks, I'm at 70%, I'm at 100%. And I'd say, okay, I just want to report, there have been 3 times in history when we have been at valuation levels somewhat similar to where we are today. The average price drop on those 3 occasions is 68%. End of post. That's information I felt people needed to know. You know, I don't care what, you know, if you think you're a lion and you're going to be at 100% stocks, fine. If you think you're a scaredy cat and you're only going to be at 60%, fine. But scaredy cats and lions are both facing the same reality, that if they invested in stocks from 1995 through the first part of 2008, they were looking at a loss of 2/3 of their money before things turned around. Obviously, if you go 30 years out, they're going to have a strong positive return. But before they get there, they're going to have a loss of 2/3 of their money. And that loss may remain in effect for a long time. So people need to know that. But that's the sort of thing I was banned for. I reported that information, and Mel Lindauer said, that's dangerous. Rob is telling people what the historical data says. That's dangerous. If people know how stocks work in the real world, they're not going to invest passively. That's dangerous. dangerous for Mel Lindauer's book sales. I think we need to report more of this dangerous information. Because the more people know about how investing works in the real world, the better we're all going to invest. And the better we all invest, the more stable our economy is going to be. Because when the middle class loses the amount of wealth that we've lost in this passive investing stock crash, it destabilizes the entire U.S. economy. We're at risk of going into a depression. Because we didn't share with our fellow community members this dangerous information. I'll just give you some idea here on the sort of numbers you need to look at. And I'm not going to give you answers. You have to go to the calculators at the website and figure out the answer for yourself. Because there is no one answer. But I can tell you what to look for. At a P10 level of 7, which is half of fair value, there's an 80% chance, you can get this by looking at the stock return predictor. There's an 80% chance that your annualized real return for 10 years is going to be above 14.2%, greater than 14.2%. I'm stating it improperly. There's an 80% chance your annualized real return will be above 14.2%. And there's an 80% chance that your annualized real return for 10 years will be below 20.2%. So it's going to be, you don't know, we can't tell you exactly what it's going to be. But we can tell you it's going to be between 14% a year and 20% a year. And that's basically true at every valuation level. There's a 6-point range of possible returns that you need to know about. And, you know, there's a 20% chance it could be less than that or above that. But there's an 80% chance that you're going to be within that range. So those are the numbers that matter the most. Now, if you know your return is going to be between 14% real, this is every year for 10 years running, not a total 14%. It's every year. Obviously, on average, you're not going to get exactly 14%. Some years you're going to get 10. Some years you're going to get 18. But you're going to have an annualized real return of something between 14% and 20%. Now, what's your risk tolerance when investing in an asset where you're going to get an annual return of between 14% real and 20% real? Well, I don't know about you, but my risk tolerance is real high for that. You almost can't lose. You know, who cares? Maybe it's going to be 14. Maybe it's going to be 16. Maybe it's going to be 19. Who the heck cares? Whatever number it is, it's great news. You can't lose. Now, at a P10 level of 14, that's where we stand today. You have an 80% chance that your 10-year annualized real return is going to be above 3.3. And you have an 80% chance your 10-year annualized real return is going to be below 9.3. Again, a 6-point range from 3.3 to 9.3. Now, again, you almost can't lose. 9.3 is wonderful. If I could tell you today you're going to get a 9.3 annualized real return for the next 10 years, you'd be jumping up and down. If I told you 3.3, you might not be jumping up and down, but you wouldn't be too upset. But you do have to be careful. That's a 10-year number. See, when you're looking at the returns you got at a P10 level of 7, the returns were also good. There are no bad possibilities. Well, here at 14, there are some. If you're going to have a real return of 3.3, and it could be less than that, there's a 20% chance it could be less than that, you might have 5 years of very bad returns. You might have 5 years of negative returns before things turn around. So there's a little bit of risk there, but it's not that great. The risk today Stocks, this is why I say at the beginning of every podcast, stocks offer a strong long-term value proposition. Now let's look at 28, double fair value, which is where we were for much of the time period from 1995 through the first part of 2008. We were above 28 for much of that, and we were a little below 28 for some of it. But 28 is probably a rough estimate of where we stood on average during those years when prices were insane. In that circumstance, you have an 80% chance that your 10-year annualized real return is going to be above a negative 2.1%. 80% chance it's going to be better than a negative 2.2%. And an 80% chance it's going to be below 3.9%. Well, that tells you what you need to know in terms of risk tolerance. If you have 10 years running where you have a negative 2% return, you're going to be bailing on stocks. Remember, it's not going to happen 2% a year. For a lot of times, if you're having a negative 10-year, most years stock returns go up. So to have a negative 2% annualized over 10 years, you might have stocks go up 5%, up 5%, up 5%, and then down 50. You know, you're going to have some bone-crushing losses to get a negative 10-year return. So there's a good chance there that you're going to have some bad stuff happening. And yes, you have a 20% chance the return could be as high as 3.9, but is that really that great? Is it worth the risk? Is it worth the risk? Because you have only a 20% chance it's going to be better than 3.9. You have an 80% chance it's going to be less. And if you bought certificates of deposit intelligently, you could have gotten a return of 3.9 on certificates of deposit. You could have gotten it from TIPS. They were paying 4.1 real. You could have gotten it from I-bonds. So why go with stocks? Why take on the risk of the negative 2% real for 10 years when there's zero risk of a negative return with TIPS or I-bonds and not too much of a risk with certificates of deposit? That's how you assess risk tolerance in the real world. What you do is you say, what are the possible outcomes? And I can't tell you what's going to happen. I can't tell you, if I could tell you precisely what the outcome was going to be, obviously you would like that. That would be a benefit, but I can't. Nobody can. But what we can do is tell you the probabilities of various outcomes. And knowing the probabilities, you can assess your risk tolerance in an intelligent way. Now, if you're in a situation where, there are different circumstances. In other words, if you're in a situation where the things you should be looking at are your life goals, your financial circumstances, and the scaredy cat question versus lion question, the extent to which losses upset you, losses do upset different people a little differently. So there's no harm in taking that into consideration. But the passive investing model makes that the dominant consideration, and it's a relatively small thing in the grand scheme of things. But for example, say that you're a multimillionaire. You have $10 million and you have nothing that you need this money for. In that case, you might even want to go with passive investing. I still don't think it's the right way to go because you'll get higher returns at less risk following a valuation-informed indexing strategy. But if you're just really lazy and you don't ever want to look at valuations, not even once every 5 years, you're just determined, then maybe you go with passive investing. And the truth is, you won't do badly because as long as you're not going to touch the money for 30 years, you're probably going to end up doing fine. The odds are strong that you will. Now say that you're in a situation, say you're 25 years old and you're thinking you want to buy a house. You're living in an apartment and you're paying rent and you're thinking, gee, I'd like to own and I want to own a house by the time I'm 30. You can't afford to have much money in stocks at a time when you're probably going to be suffering big losses. You know, at a time when you're likely to be seeing a 68% drop in your portfolio, why would you want to put a large amount of money into that portfolio, knowing that you're going to need the money, you know, to buy a house? Now, you may not need the money in your 401k to buy the house, but the amount of money you have in your 401k is obviously going to affect how much money you feel you can put toward the house. In other words, you're not going to, you know, if your 401k is growing, you can afford to spend more on your house. If your 401k is declining, you have to conserve resources. And this is what the passive investors miss out on. By ignoring everything that happens from year 1 to year 30, by ruling all that out of consideration, they make it impossible to make intelligent decisions. You need to be thinking, when am I going to need this money? Is it going to affect me if my portfolio balance is down? These sorts of questions. And you can't begin to analyze those questions unless you acknowledge the effect of valuations, because valuation is the dominant effect in stock investing. It's the single most important factor. And passive investors won't look at it, because if you look at valuations, you're not going to be passive. You're going to be changing your allocation. So you're taking a vow not to assess, not to do a reasonable risk assessment. So what I argue is that you need to give up on passive investing. Don't go into this thing where you're saying, oh, you know, we assessed risk improperly. Passive investing's okay, we just did the risk assessment improperly. It's impossible to do the risk assessment properly so long as you're a passive investor. There was a guy who did a good job of summing it up, and I'm going to see if I can pull up his post, if I can find it. I don't know if I'll be able to find it quickly, but there was a guy at the Bogleheads board. They had a thread over there called Plan B something, and I'll just read this paragraph and see if this helps. He says, I should note that I've always struggled with paradigm one, even in bull markets. Let's say I have $100. I decide I can tolerate a $25 loss, since that will still leave me with $75, which I decide is enough. So I choose an appropriate asset allocation to reflect my risk tolerance. If the market does well, going to 150, I can afford to take more risk, since I still only need that $75 and can tolerate a 50% loss instead of just a 25% loss when I had $100. And thus, it could theoretically be okay for me to increase my equity exposure. That makes sense to me. If the market goes down, say to $75, I would need to reduce or even eliminate my equity exposure, since I still need $75 and can't tolerate any more losses to my portfolio. Just because the market's down doesn't mean it can't keep going down. I could understand maintaining a constant asset allocation in bull markets, namely, don't get greedy. But when my portfolio loses money, it could still lose even more money. If I use Adrian's or the investment planning Stickies formula, I would need to adjust my asset allocation every time the market drops, because I can tolerate less of a loss. Never made sense to me. That guy is hitting on the problem with the passive investing model. With the passive investing model, where you ignore valuations, the psychological pull you feel is always to increase your allocation when prices go up. Because when prices go up, you're feeling rich. You're saying, I have more money than I had before. Risk isn't really a problem for me. My risk tolerance has increased. The more prices go up, the more your risk tolerance goes up in passive investing. And just the opposite. When prices are going down, as they have recently, people are saying, whoa, I can't take any more risk. I can't stand another loss. And they're selling their stocks because their quote-unquote risk tolerance is low at just the worst time for doing so. Everything is backwards in the passive investing model. But see, when you go to rational investing, what you're doing is you're tapping into something called the reality principle. And it should be your friend. The reality principle should be your friend. And you see, in the real world, the way it works is when prices go up to insane levels, the risk of stocks also goes up, dramatically so. And when you know that, all rational investors know that, and they study it, you know, they keep it in mind. When you know that, you're not going to feel tempted to increase your allocation. When prices go up, you're going to lower your allocation because the risk is just going to the moon. On the other hand, when prices go down, you're going to say, hey, you know, I'm not happy that I've suffered this loss maybe, but the long-term value propositions of stocks is going way up. And of course, I haven't lost much because when prices were insane, I only had 10% in stocks or 20%. So I haven't really suffered much of a loss. And now I've got this juicy long-term return available to me. I think I'll increase my allocation. See, they always miss this. When I would talk about, you know, I was out of stocks. And they'd say, oh, Rob, you're a scaredy cat. And they'd say, you know, you say you're going to get back into stocks when prices go down, but you're not. You're going to always be a scaredy cat. And the answer to that is no. If you lower your stock allocation when prices are insane, you're not going to be a scaredy cat when they drop low because you don't suffer the losses. The scaredy cats are the passive investors. They made themselves scaredy cats. I'm going to read one more thing and then I'll close. But this is a comment from Drip Guy, and he's one of the most vicious of the goons at the Goon Central Board. But he put a post to the Vanguard Diehards Board, and he had a sentence that was perfect. He says, now that I think about it, actually perversely, the less people believe in the efficient market theory, the truer it likely is. And the more people believe in it, the more mispricing becomes likely, in my humble opinion. That's exactly right. And here's a post that I put to the Goon Central Board, expanding on this insight by Drip Guy, this wonderful insight. That nails it. When people follow their common sense, which tells them that they obviously need to adjust their stock allocation when prices go to insanely dangerous levels, market prices are self-regulating. When prices get too high, people naturally sell, and the selling brings prices back to reasonable levels again. However, when people believe that the market is by some magical process efficient, regardless of what investors do, the process by which prices are made efficient breaks down. The market can no longer regulate itself in a world in which passive investing has become popular. We are the market. The market makes sense so long as we do what is needed to make it make sense. Advocates of passive investing urge us to invest irrationally. When we go along, the market becomes wildly inefficient and we all pay a horrible price. The first law of stock investing is never, ever, ever believe someone who tells you that there is no need to apply human reason to your investing decisions. It never has worked. It never can work. The market can be reasonably efficient, but only if we are willing to do what it takes to correct those who argue that it becomes efficient through some magical process that doesn't involve us selling stocks at times of insanely dangerous prices. It was the promotion of the efficient market theory that caused the market to become more inefficient in recent years than it has ever been at any earlier time in history. The people who came up with the efficient market theory were onto something, but they did not develop a full grasp of the factors that caused efficiency. They didn't understand how important it is to stress to investors that they always be sure to adjust their stock allocation in response to big price changes as their means of doing their part to keep the market efficient. It is that mistake that caused the economic crisis we are living through today. It won't cost us money to fix that mistake. The cost comes in terms of courage. We need all who promoted passive investing and all who listened, who invested pursuant to this theory, to own up to the mistake. Once we see that, stock investing makes sense again. Once we see that, stock investing becomes safe again. Once we see that, we all begin to feel confidence again that our political and economic system works again. The passive investing mistake is the biggest mistake ever made in the history of personal finance. And Drip Guy, in his words above, put his finger precisely on the essence of the mistake. Yes, the market wants to be efficient. We are in the market after all, and market efficiency helps us. But market efficiency is not achieved through some magical process. Market efficiency is achieved by making people aware on a daily basis of the price that is paid by all of us when we permit our fellow investors to get caught up in the emotional idea that it is okay not to adjust one's stock allocation in response to wild and insane price swings. It's not okay. For just the reasons Drip Guy points out, invest passively and you destroy the efficient market. Destroy the efficient market and you delay your retirement by years or even decades. Risk tolerance is really risk in the stock market is not an inward thing. It's not something you determine by psychoanalyzing yourself and finding out whether you're a lion or a scaredy cat. Risk tolerance is determined by looking at the PE10 level and seeing how nuts your fellow investors have gone, and by doing your part to keep them from going nuts. We have to stop thinking about investing as something we do as individuals sitting in a room. And we have to start taking responsibility for our fellow investors. Because when passive investing becomes popular, our economic system breaks down and fails. When people lose the amount of money middle-class investors lost in the passive investing stock crash, the economy cannot continue to function. And we all have a responsibility for that. Anyone who didn't speak up against passive investing from 1995 through the first part of 2008 played a role. And that included me. I didn't speak up until May 13, 2002. I learned about the flaws in the old school safe withdrawal rate studies when I read John Bogle's book in the mid-1990s. So I'm guilty. You're guilty. Unless your name's Robert Shiller, you're guilty. We're all guilty. What we have to do is learn from this mistake and never make it again. And we need to speak out. The way to have a better risk tolerance is to have stocks be less risky. And the way to have stocks be less risky is to make sure everyone you know, your friends, your neighbors, your coworkers, your fellow community members, your family members, make everyone understand that valuations affect long-term returns. And to invest passively is to invest insanely. Tell your friends, please. That's how we save this market. That's how we help people regain confidence in the stock market, in our economic system, and in our political system, frankly. The failure of our political leaders to speak out against this has put us in a pretty pickle. That's done. But we can learn from the experience, and we should. We should learn from the experience. I love to hear your feedback. If you have something to say, positive or negative, about the podcast, please check out that Contact Rob button at the left side of every page of the website. Good luck with your investing strategies. Take care.